Good morning, folks. June 29th, and we're approaching the end of this month, obviously, headed into the final countdown for the birthday of America, 250-year anniversary this weekend, July 4th. Looking forward to that and all of the patriotic stuff that is surrounding it, all of the events and everything else. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We'll visit with Guy Williams, Chairman and CEO of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll talk about rent freezes. What does that mean? We'll talk about these high summertime temperatures. People in England and France dying as a result thereof. It looks like they were looked upon air conditioning very disfavorably, and things are changing there really quick. The economic impact and what factors are causing countries to succeed in World Cup soccer. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about also their reaction to the United States. I have had more fun watching and reading articles and stories about foreigners that have never been to the U.S. and have these preconceived notions, and they're here, and you know what? They're having a damn good time. And they're talking about how friendly everybody is and how everyone has received them with open arms and have joined in the celebration with them. I just love these stories, one after the other, and what people are talking about. It was a story, it might have been in a Wall Street Journal. A couple of guys went to Costco, and they got lost inside of Costco. They had never seen a store so big ever in their life. It's just funny little nuanced stories like that that have really been kind of a little sideshow to the incredible athletes that are playing in the World Cup, which has been a lot of fun. Debbie Bresler is going to join us to talk about some of these festivities that are going on right here on the Mississippi River with the Crescent City Countdown Club. Time to go forth on the river. We'll hear all about the world-class 4th of July celebration marking America's 250th birthday. Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics, will talk about Saturday's runoffs, you know, what that means, how it turned out. And as we head into the next election cycle, how does this shape up and what does it actually mean? Matt Rosen, CEO and founder of Aleda, he's an AI expert. A recent story in the Washington Post tested major AI chatbots and found that some gave answers that leaned left more than they presented conservative arguments. In fact, the Trump administration and conservatives have been talking about this and being concerned about it for quite some time. In fact, there was even, I think, an executive action taken relative to this. We'll find out more about why these biases are revealing themselves in this way and how does AI really actually work. Lot going on, obviously. We'll reserve comments about the elections until Ron Fauché comes on at 11 o'clock. But there were a couple of articles that I wanted to talk about that are just very interesting to me about why the city finds itself in the position that it finds itself in today. And none of this really has anything to do with the Moreno administration. They inherited this mess. And as they're going through all of the things that they have to do to remediate some of these policies that are very antiquated, the ineptitude that has been going on for years. But meanwhile, all that's fine and dandy, but the taxpayers are the ones that are suffering. And they're suffering in a huge way for so many years of not keeping your eye on the ball and not being willing to consume political capital. We had elected leaders who were basically chickens. They wouldn't do the right thing ever because they didn't want to face the political consequences. And meanwhile, you know, we find ourselves down and out, and we wonder why. And I'm going to translate some of this into, you know, articles about New Orleans suffering a number of the line item vetoes. Well, it kind of begs the question of why would we reward the city with state money when we've squandered so many opportunities to do the right thing over the years? And again, this has nothing to do with the Moreno administration, but you're going to suffer the ills of the lack of effort, the lack of paying attention to what needed to be done. So the other day, the Louisiana legislative auditor is calling for reforms of accrued leave, vacation pay. We call it annual leave in government. The city of New Orleans paid out more than $4.2 million in accrued leave in 2025. The payouts went to about 400 people who left civil service jobs, including employees from the NOPD, the NOFD, and 18 of those employees received checks exceeding $50,000. The largest single payout, nearly $450,000, went to a fire district chief. Another payout in June of in this month, the NOPD fired former Major Raymond Burkhart in June of 2026. The city said he will receive $500,000, a $500,000 payout for accumulated leave. And it would have been $700,000, but he was demoted. So then the value of each hour of leave that he had on the books was recalculated to that of the salary of a lieutenant as opposed to the salary of a major. So he lost $200,000 in value by that demotion. Now, this has nothing to do with these individuals that are receiving these dollars. They received these dollars as a result of a policy by the city of New Orleans. A little bit of a history lesson. Most, and I will say most government sectors, when GASB, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, changed the rules to say that all of these dollars, the value of this leave, which a lot of jurisdictions had unlimited accruals, you could accrue in the entire time that you're there. Let's say you get 2 weeks a year. You didn't take the 2 weeks. You could accrue it. It goes on the books. Next year, you don't take the 2 weeks. It goes on the books. The following year, same thing. Goes on the books. A lot of jurisdictions had very liberal leave policies, 21 days a year, for example, in a lot of jurisdictions that you could account, you could accrue for. And it just kept going to the books, going to the books. Every time you got a promotion, your value of your leave went up at that point in time. So those that started out as a deputy and started putting money in leave and ends up as a deputy chief, the value of their leave was exponentially greater as a result of their promotions. Well, at some point in time, and I forgot what year it was in, GASB changed the rules and said the value of that time had to be booked on your financials as an unfunded accrued liability. And the net effect of that, for those that were not learned in accounting and didn't really understand, is that it would make the entity look as though it was broke, that you had more liabilities than you had assets or cash. And there was a big concern amongst governmental accountants as to how you were going to explain this away. GASB and FASB, the Financial Accounting Standard Boards, they became much closer as to how government was going to account for certain things that traditionally we didn't have to account for it in that way, more like a for-profit entity, which I think is, in many respects, a good thing because it caused a lot of people to really get their eye on the ball. So a lot of jurisdictions, and I was the chief financial officer at the time when this all came about, I went to the CEO, Harry Lee, and I said, hey, this is going to be a problem. It's going to be a problem politically. How do you explain this away? We have this unlimited accrual basis. We need to change. We already had a policy that it wasn't a day for a day. Your value of your leave up until a certain number of days was valued at 1-for-1. After that, it was 2-for-1, 3-for-1, 4-for-1, 5-for-1. So we had already modified the policies many years in advance so that we tried to limit that amount of liability. But this unlimited accrual thing was going to come back and haunt us. So we decided to freeze the plan. We freeze the plan on a date certain, and we bought out everybody's leave. And everybody went back to a zero balance. And we created a new policy where you couldn't accrue that much leave, and you either used it or you lost it. And we allowed for a period of time to be utilized that aligned with our disability policies and other policies that we had in our health plan so that people would not have to suffer not having a paycheck. And we had it make more sense as to how this was going to play itself out. These are the things that you never hear about that go on behind closed doors. But the truth be told, you should, because it has serious and significant financial consequences, as was laid out in news stories that were reported about what the legislative auditor is saying, that, hey, the city, you need to reform this. You can't afford this. You have a budget deficit of about $100 million, down from $220 million. You're still teetering, and you're paying out in leave over $4 million in 2025. Somebody better do something. Now, the truth be told, as I said before, this is not the Moreno administration's creation. This is like the last four mayors not paying attention, not willing to make the difficult decisions and doing the right thing here, because this is absolutely craziness. You will not find this in the private sector. It doesn't exist. Trust me. Nowhere will they have a benefit as lucrative as this. Right? Where your leave, every time you're promoted, goes up exponentially in value. It's absolutely craziness that we do not have our hands around this situation. I've actually talked about this many times on this show with former council members, former CFOs, about the city's policy, that they're very antiquated, they're setting themselves up for failure, and they need to get their hands around this situation sooner rather than later. Now, is it a popular thing with your employees? Hell no, it's not. Absolutely not. But you're paid to make tough decisions. And you have to make them, because you're the fiduciary for the public. Yes, you try to balance your fiduciary obligation to the public as it relates to being fair to your employees. Easiest way to do that is to look at your peer group. What are your peers doing? Well, most of your peers are not allowing this to occur any longer. They can't afford it. And certainly, the private sector doesn't do it at all, which is a very telling situation. Right? And, you know, we hear all the time, well, you know, the public sector doesn't make what the private sector does. Well, that gap is closed a lot. a lot. And the benefit package far exceeds the benefit package that's offered in it far exceeds the benefit package that is that is received in the private sector. So hopefully this causes something to be done. It's a shame that the legislative auditor has to call this out. The administrations in the past should have addressed this situation. We wouldn't be in this situation now. This policy right now needs to be frozen, and a new policy needs to be put in place. And you got to figure out how you're going to end up funding and paying out this old policy. But it needs to freeze, because every time you're making promotions and everything else, you have everybody's bank leave going up exponentially in value, and you're bankrupting the city. And it just doesn't make any sense. So hopefully they'll freeze the policy, garner a new policy, and move forward. Let's pivot real quick to these line item vetoes. Nobody likes, you know, the fact that elections have consequences, right? Democrat city, Republican governor, Republican-controlled state legislature. There's the friction. We talk about this all the time. All the time. But when we dig deeper and we go to the projects themselves, for example, $16 million designated for the redevelopment efforts at the municipal auditorium. Why would the state want to send the city $16 million for the municipal auditorium? Administration after administration after administration have squandered every opportunity of utilizing FEMA dollars to renovate and get that building into some kind of shape, instead letting it sit there and just fall apart. And now we have an expectation that the state should dump $16 million in this hole? I should think not. I could tell you that if I were the governor, and that's how I try to view these things. If I was a governor and I'm assessing this situation, I'm like, not happening. Not happening. The state should not have to suffer the ills of the failed leadership of administration after administration after administration in dealing with not only Armstrong Park, but the municipal auditorium. How many stories have we read about the failures of leadership in the city, both at the council as well as the mayor's administration, in dealing with this particular issue? Citizen-led initiatives trying to figure out what to do, citizens groups, nobody really taking the ball, bringing it across the finish line ever. Why? Should say not, right? I mean, it doesn't make sense. When we talk about homelessness and funding for certain not-for-profits, look, I get it. But there's a reckoning right now, you know, as it relates to some of what's going on when we talk about this industrial complex of homelessness and how that's going to be ultimately funded. There is a huge chasm between the belief system of some in the city of New Orleans and obviously the present administration in Baton Rouge. So again, when you sit there and you wonder why this is the way it is, it's kind of like, well, let's look at the data. And what we find, and even some of the most forward-leaning business folks in the city that have been very giving on this issue are like, this is not working. It's not working, and we need to do something differently. So I don't know why it's a big surprise that money is at risk. And not this particular organization, but there are other homeless organizations that actually, I think, the legislative auditor's been looking at, and they're not willing to give any answers to some of the questions. So if I'm sitting there in the governor's mansion and I'm looking at all of this, what would I do? I'd send them the money. Until there's a collective and collaborative effort that all of this is aligned in a meaningful way, which makes sense. So the $2 million for the Ellis Marcellus Center for Music. It's a great program. There are a lot of great music programs. I'm curious, if the state is funding music programs around the state, then this would not be fair. But $2 million? It's a lot of money. We develop these great not-for-profit institutions that end up relying on government funding over and over and over again. So when do you wean yourself off of the proverbial state budget tit? It's what everybody wants to know at some point in time. How does this work? How many great programs are going to rely on government funding at the end of the day? And what we find out now is that there are a lot of NGOs and government organizations that have one revenue source, either the federal government or state government. And I'm not suggesting that that's the case here with the Ellis Marcellus Center for Music, because I know differently. I know people that have actually served on that board. It's a fine institution. But again, when is enough enough? And when is it that the jurisdiction or the city itself take on these concerns and these challenges? And $1 million for the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office. Well, you know, again, unless and until that is turned around and we begin to see improvements in the way that we're managing it, managing the money and everything else, and I have a lot of high expectations for the new sheriff. I think she's going to do a good job. I wish her the best. But until you prove yourself, why would you just send money? Again, we have this mindset that we have this beggar's mentality, as though we're shaking cans on street corners, and when people don't give us money, we're upset. I mean, it's like we have to prove to the world that we're going to be doing things. We're going to be clicking on all cylinders. We have a new administration, just over 100 days in office, and doing some great things, but that has to continue down the road. When you're paying out leave amounts like this, this is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. And one has to wonder, well, if you've got all this money to squander and you're not doing what most organizations have modified years ago, why should we continue to pay the freight? It's a legitimate question. And it demands legitimate answers and legitimate action. And a lot of people are waiting and seeing and watching. We'll be right back. So folks, a number of folks are turning to artificial intelligence for answers about a number of issues, politics, policy, just news in general. But are those answers neutral? A Washington Post investigation tested major AI chatbots and found some gave answers that leaned left more often than they presented conservative arguments, something that conservatives as well as the White House has been very concerned with. Matt Rosen, CEO and founder of Aleda AI, he's an AI expert, joins us. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on this morning.
So, Matt, when folks go to AI, I'm curious whether or not the expectations that they have are actually matched by what is produced by that software.
Yeah, I think it depends what you're going to AI for. And, you know, I read this Washington Post article as well, obviously, and, you know, it was a pretty small subset of use cases they went after. But, you know, I think when you go to AI, you have to know what you're looking for. And if you're just going in and asking for the latest news, you know, I think there's probably better sources to do it. We like to use AI really to solve problems, you know, come up with it, you know, artifacts for emails. There's a lot of things you can use AI for, but I think just going and say, hey, what's the latest news out there? There's probably better places to do it. And, you know, AI wants to please you. It's going to give you back things you want to hear. And so it gets to know you. And it's also trained on all the information that's out there on the internet. And so you really have to know what you're looking for when you go out there. And you have to have it cite its sources, because oftentimes it's going to, the first answer it gives you might not be the right answer.
So when you say there are alternatives, such, can you give us some examples?
I mean, I look at Google News, I look at Yahoo News, I look at this Ground Truth News when I'm looking for my news, because it says which articles lean left or right. Because, you know, where this article came from was they went and they had a bunch of different AI models give responses, but only in 30 words, which is very short, on different things. And what the research found was that most of the models lean left. I don't find this surprising at all, because if you think about many journalists and many authors lean to the left, and if you consider that AI is trained on all the world's knowledge, more of it than not is probably a little bit more liberal leaning than conservative leaning. And so, you know, what this article says, if you're going in and asking questions, it's going to present things with a slightly left point of view. And so what I did, one of the things I did to test this out was I took the article and I actually put it into three different engines. I put it into Gemini, I put it into OpenAI, and I put it into Anthropic's Claude. And they all pretty much gave me the same answers. Yeah, this is the information we're trained on. So if you want a more conservative point of view, you probably need to ask for it, ask for the sources that it was pulling the actual answer from, which it will absolutely do.
Because the general search, and I guess that's what conservatives and others have been concerned with, is that the mainstream media, I think it's fair to say and safe to say, leans left. And their perspective is going to be more left. In fact, there was a study done the other day that there were more stories done about the reflecting pool than there was about the intelligence information that Tulsi Gabbard released as she was walking out of the door relative to Anthony Fauci and how he may have lied to Congress. Kind of find that a little bit interesting that the reflecting pool would be written about more than
pretty wild.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of like, I rest my case, Your Honor. I mean, it's like I need not say anything more, right?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. So what I advise listeners is, if you are going to use AI to help you find news or, you know, ask questions about things, maybe use a couple different AI engines. There's good free ones out there. And maybe ask it a question deeper too, is where are you pulling this information from? And, you know, could you compare it against this? So just don't take the first answer at face value. And that's, unfortunately, we live in like this age of information, but yet there's so much disinformation or information aggregated for one person's point of view or one side's point of view. It's like, if you don't question things a little bit, you're bound to get answers that might not be the whole truth. And so I think you got to dig a little bit more and not just take the first AI answer as the only one, and dig a bit deeper, be curious, ask a few more questions before just taking the first thing you get and running with it.
We're visiting with Matt Rosen, CEO and founder of Aleda. Matt, he's an AI expert. Matt, I guess we're partially to blame, right? We're lazy, and we're looking for the path of least resistance. You know, we live in for the moment. We want the answer now. Some of these studies that I've looked at and some of the answers provided by AI, they don't even make sense. I mean,
no.
You know, and it's kind of like read the answer and reflect for like just maybe 25 seconds, you'd say to yourself, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. No, and
we don't. AI's we're off and running.
AI is a bit sycophantic. It wants you to come back and use it more. So it's going to also tell you what you want to hear unless you say, please challenge me. And so you have people that develop relationships with these AIs, and it tells them exactly what they want to hear so that they keep coming back and using it. And so, in fact, as an organization, one of the things we try and do is get people off of using the public models and at least get the models embedded in their own environment and talking to their information, because ultimately what the model's being fed with is going to give a quality or non-quality result. And if you just go out to the public Gemini model and ask it questions about your health and your personality and should you be on a diet or what should you do about this condition, you're not apt to always get accurate information. But yeah, people want easy answers and they don't want to dig and do the deeper research. And so for those that are going out and just taking the first answer Gemini or Claude gives you, you might be running with information that's not correct, but presented to you very well.
And I suspect that a lot of the urban myths that we have floating around in society today started right there with being lazy and using an AI model that throws something out there that just doesn't even make any sense.
Or heck, a lot of people get their news from TikTok these days. my assistant, that's where she gets it all. I'm like, seriously, do you cross-check it anywhere? She's like, occasionally. And this is what the younger generation's running with.
Again, laziness, right? I mean, how do I ask this question? So how far do we let this go? I mean, obviously, there are a lot of concerns out there about moderating this in some way, like putting a governor on it and modulating it, if that's even the appropriate word, to make sure that this thing, it just doesn't go off and running and has our whole world all screwed up based on misinformation.
You know, that's a really great question, and it's a big problem to solve. I do think the government's trying to step in and, look at some of these newest models, which, let me take a step back. One of the biggest challenges is the two main guys that have brought AI to the world, Sam Altman and Dario Amodei, I'll call them out here, have done an absolutely terrible job about talking about the great things AI can do. They've been just doom and gloom about how many jobs it was going to cut, how bad it's going to be, how these models aren't safe. And you saw Anthropic got banned, but it's almost as if they'd asked for it. They said, hey, this thing's so dangerous, it can break into anything. So we're going to give it to a really small group of users and make sure it works great before we release it to everyone else. They release it to everyone else. Like, oh, wait, we're still worried something could go wrong. And then now you have the U.S. government reviewing these models. And we're in a race against the Chinese. We need to keep up. And so banning them is not the answer. I do think maybe rolling them to a smaller group of people first. And I also am not a huge fan of kids of all ages using these things because they're not going to learn to learn. So I think social media, the fact you see other countries, putting, you have to be 16 to use it or some parental consent. I'm not opposed to seeing something similar happen with AI, but at the same time, we have to keep up. This technology is going to drive the future. And so we have to be educated on it, but we have to be smart about how we use it, how we deploy it, and how we use it personally. And so I think it's a question that a lot of smart people are going to have to come together and solve over the years to come.
Well, my concern, and I think you would probably agree, especially with younger kids, is that what happens to critical thinking, right, when you just become totally reliant on this technology?
it goes out the window. There's studies where you have had people use AI for there's one study recently where they had AI helping them spot fake news, and then they got better at spotting fake news. It's like you lose your ability to critically think. It's like if you lay in bed for 3 days, you start to lose muscle mass. Same thing happens with your brain if you're not critically thinking. And I think, you know, as you get into some of the older generations, you know, if you've been taught to critically think, it doesn't go away as fast. But like for my kids who are teenagers, I'm like, hey, that's fine if you want to use AI to help you understand something, but you better put it in your own words, and you better make sure you understand it, and you better ask for its sources before you just go on with, hey, that's the answer. And I feel like this is technology that we're expecting these kids to use when they show up at work. But I don't know that schools are equipped to teach them how to use it. So you see a lot of schools going back to the Socratic method of, hey, you turn in a paper, you're going to be asked to defend it. I think we're going to have to be smart about how we, you know, embed this into our society. And I don't know that we're off to the best start.
The other thing about it is that, I don't know if they do this with intentionality. I would suspect not. But you make the vulnerable sections of our population even more vulnerable, right?
How do you mean?
I mean, folks that have some type of impairment, that don't have that heightened ability to reason and things of that nature, that end up relying on this technology, they already have expressed and overt vulnerabilities, but you just highlight them and you make them worse when you have all this bad information floating around.
Oh, completely agree. Yeah, people are getting their information from TikTok or Gemini and not interrogating it a bit more, that they are at risk of getting misinformation. In fact, I think, you know, there's a lot of people that prey on that. And I think that's unfortunate. And I think really the only thing you can do is try and educate people. And that can be difficult. But everyone has access to a smartphone. And so they've got access to these models. They've got access to social media. Without us doing a better job of educating the population on how these models and this information could be used, you know, it could go well, it could go poorly. You know, I tend to be optimistic. I think there's, you know, this technology is going to make many goods and services more affordable. I feel like it's going to help solve a lot of diseases. But I think the counter to that is, you know, if you've ever seen the movie Idiocracy, where you end up in a world in 600 years that nobody knows how anything works, that's a scary proposition. And so, you know, we've got to be very thoughtful about how we deploy these tools and how we educate people to use them.
And how we regulate it, because as we all know, anytime you step into the regulatory field, it's a very slippery slope, and there are a lot of unintended consequences, right?
There are, because what will happen, you see this is happening right now, is, you know, the latest version of OpenAI is being reviewed by the government and a small group of users, and there are people right now evaluating using some of the Chinese open source models, because you know what? They're free. You can download them. You can put them on your server, and they don't cost anything to run. And so what you risk by limiting our ability to roll out new technology is that people just go find it somewhere else. And we are absolutely in a race with the Chinese to have the strongest AI. And, you know, there's, by regulating it, it incents people to go use their technology versus ours. And that is a risk I worry about. I really hope over the next months and weeks to come, they figure out a better framework for evaluating this and getting it in people's hands and educating people on how to use it instead of just stalling forward progress.
Absolutely. Matt Rosen, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate the time and the insight. CEO and founder of Aleda, an AI expert. Have a great week.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Well, I got a text here that said the city did change their policy back in 2000, that this individual left in 2000, and you can't have over 45 annual days carry over from year to year. Well, that doesn't explain how an individual in 2026, which is 26 years after you left, if that policy had changed, how someone would have $700,000 payout on the books, right? If you were to take, a deputy chief's position and say that the hourly rate was about $100-something an hour, you would still end up with over 1 year's worth of annual leave, 365 days worth of annual leave in order to get to that number. this individual wasn't at that level, and the fire chief obviously was. But it, you know, part of the issue is, and we've seen what's happened, is that no one was accounting for leave. They weren't accounting for when they were at work and when they weren't at work. And it'd be curious to find out, these people never went on a vacation. They never took leave, ever. And they just had these balances that were generated. It goes a little deeper than just what the outcome is as to the balance of the hours. It's whether or not there has been an open and honest accounting of those hours during throughout those years as well. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. All right, folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. The runoffs are over, and now we head into the general election, and we'll find out what the mood of all of the voters are. There are no restrictions in the general election. You get to vote for whoever you want to vote for. I know that's been very confusing for a number of folks, and we'll also look at a number of other political stories that are shaping the state and the country, from Baton Rouge to Washington, find out what folks are thinking about. And then in the back half of the hour, we'll visit with Debbie Bressler, Crescent City Countdown Club. Time to go to the 4th. On the river, we'll hear about all that New Orleans' world-class 4th of July celebration has to offer, marking America's 250th birthday. And Guy Williams is back, so we'll visit with Guy Williams in the noon hour. Got a lot to talk about there as well. So stay tuned. We will be right back with a great lineup when we return. And also just want to remind folks that today on Sports Talk with Mike Dottiglia and Steve Geller, the latest on Lane Kiffin and LSU recruiting, plus the buzz around the black and gold and Tyler Shuck, who has Houdats excited this season. How high can the quarterback's game rise with the revamped Saints offense? And they'll hear from the newest Pelican and New Orleans native, Jaron Pierre Jr. Huddle up with Mike and Steve today from 4 to 8 on WWL.